It's an appropriate opening illustration, but I don't want to bore you with the same story twice. It's a culturally tricky illustration, but I think it's got some merit here. So, short story longer. Grew up in northern Saskatchewan. There's not a lot of skiing up there, but when we were younger, my dad kind of thought, this would kind of be fun, let's go skiing. So basically, you don't ski from a mountain down to a valley in Saskatchewan generally. You ski from the plain down into a river, you know, down a riverbank, right down the side of it. So, you know, it's what we got. So there's a ski hill in the part of the province that I grew up in that is operated by the local First Nations community, and called Ochapoise Mountain. Somebody was having a real ambitious day when they named it. So we were driving there, and we kind of grew up in the north, so we were sort of doing this dead reckoning thing. Like, we're just kind of going to go cross country. It's sort of over there, and we'll hit this road, and it should kind of take us to where we want to be. And, you know, you kind of do lots of that sort of navigating up there. So we got most of the way there, and it wasn't kind of showing up where we thought it should be. And it's not the sort of thing you just miss, you know, a ski area. It's not like you're trying to find a country mailbox. It's bigger. So we thought, well, finally we kind of got to the point where it was like, you know, we should pull over and we should ask for directions. It's a car full of guys. I mean, you kind of leave that step till late in the process. So we did, and we happened to be, we were already on the band's territory, and so we were on the reservation, so we just pulled into a home there, really feeling, I think, this acute sense of being out of our cultural milieu. But, you know, that was okay, but it was a certain sensation, I think, for us, especially for us as kids. Anyway, my dad suggested that I go to the door and ask for directions. I don't think he did it out of fear. I think it was probably a parenting moment. But anyway, we've never discussed it. We should. So I go to the door, and I knock on the door, and this Aboriginal gentleman comes to the door, and I explain what I'm looking for, and he kind of quietly listens to my dilemma, and then he points with his chin, because in that culture, that's a very common thing to do. He points with his chin, and he says, "Go northeast." And then he closes the door. And that's all he says is, "Go northeast." Well, if you've ever looked at a map of the shield, everything goes northeast. I mean, that's the way the glaciers went. Like, all the lakes go that direction. Everything is northeast from where you are in the north. But that was it. That was all the direction we got. So I walked back to the car and got in and sat down and closed the door. And my dad said, "What'd he say?" I said, "Go northeast." Dad kind of looks at me and he says, "That's it." "Yeah, that's it." So we backed out of the drive and we went northeast. 10 minutes later, we were at the ski hill. It's awesome. So now, I have to connect the dots, right? I have this obligation to make the opening illustration belong to the rest of what's going on. I said in the email this week, we were talking about oracles. And I told you the story briefly about Hen Wen, the oracular pig. And the books, by the way, are the Prydain Chronicles. So just in case you want to read more about Hen Wen, you can do that in the Prydain Chronicles. But oracles, by their nature, are a little bit like the directions that I got at this person's house. They kind of are a gesture in a direction. Doesn't mean they're bad direction. It just means there's a lack of particularity sometimes about them. It doesn't mean they don't unfold into an actual arrival or an actual thing. But it does mean that they don't tend to have this character about them that says, as the directions I was expecting might have said, "Well, go back to the end of the drive, turn left, drive 200 meters, turn right." They don't behave like the GPS on your dash at all. They behave like somebody whose sense of direction is steeped in an ancient culture. They behave like somebody who says, "You want to find what you're looking for? Go northeast." That's kind of the way they act. So we're looking at a whole bunch of oracles this morning, and I think it's important to kind of set the stage for what is that anyway. The word sounds a little bit, you know, like something from a dark hooded movie. Pop culture kind of has this its own take on this idea of oracle. Embedded in the idea of an oracle is that it points toward the future. Right? That's kind of just part of the thing itself. And the word actually simply means prophetic foretelling. That's kind of the short definition. So, but it's always pointing, an oracle always points to something that's to come. And in popular culture, we kind of have this idea of telling the future that tends to be dominated by telling the near future.
That's kind of tends to be our frame of reference in a lot of this stuff. This is, we're just coming up on the time of the year right now where you should start watching, you may choose to start watching the newsstand, you know, on the checkout line at Safeway for Nostradamus. He always kind of shows up right around now, maybe a little later, a little closer to New Year's.
December 21st.
There you go. Right? So watch for it, because there will be oracles, and they will be posted at Safeway. And you can read them while you're waiting to hand over your money and know what the next year is going to be. Rarely do the ancient works of Nostradamus seem to gesture beyond a year in the Safeway lineup. It's kind of like, what we kind of get that's oracular in our culture is more like a cosmic weather forecast, right? It's like, tomorrow you can expect, it's kind of got this really tight time frame. And I think probably most of us, having been exposed to that, even if we've never thought about it, would regard the whole milieu as about as useful or dependable as a weather forecast. And really, it kind of feels like we might just be better off to just step outside and see what's going on. I'm a CBC fan, and you guys know that, because I've visited that upon you. But I can't help finding myself living as a skeptic whenever that voiceover comes onto CBC that says, news and weather you can trust. I mean, I get the marketing part of it, but I wonder, like, what would the marketing alternative be? Right? I mean, really, what's the you could say something like, news and weather that isn't worth your time. You know, change stations would be the short voiceover. Of course they're going to say it's trustworthy, but we have our skepticism about it, right? We're kind of coming in the church calendar. This is the first Sunday of Advent. We're just coming into the season of Advent. It's a really curious time of year for our culture, because never mind Nostradamus, who's still waiting in the wings, in Advent, in this run-up of December to Christmas, we get a whole bunch of what amount to mini oracles in our culture, little predictions about the future. They don't tend to get called that, but they're prognostication. They're looking ahead at what's to come. I heard one again this morning on the drive in. I'd heard it last week already, and so I kind of had it in my notes, and I was driving in, and it got revisited. One of the morning shows on CBC next week is doing a feature on what it kind of takes to parent children in a season of runaway greed, basically. And they're asking the question, what could you do as a family that would help this season to not simply be an occasion for greed, but actually to rather be a season that is a holiday with gifts? So the high bar is that this is a season that is a holiday with gifts. That's an interesting high water mark. They used the phrase this morning in talking about this, in critiquing the advertising community, they used the phrase must-wants. Pay attention. Must-want? Where is that from must-need? Like, what kind of motion is that, ideologically, practically? So now we have advertisers visibly educating our culture, our children in particular, but any of us are vulnerable, from the perspective of creating a culture of must-want. What is the horsepower behind must? Why must I want that? What compels me to want that? If I don't want it, what happens to my experience in the culture? How am I treated if I don't want that thing that I'm being so vigorously told I must want? So this is where we live. What CBC is doing with that feature is small O oracle. What's coming? What's coming is unmitigated greed. Where? In the near future. This season. We don't know exactly what it's going to unfold like, but it's coming. Where is it? It's northeast. Right? It's just generally over there. We're going to run into it. That's a little oracle. I wonder what it would take for us as a culture, to kind of crack that time frame a little bit. I wonder what it would take for there to be a popular voice, a newsstand, news broadcast level voice, that dares to look further down the road, that dares to speak with some semblance of confidence, or even if not confidence, then courage, to say 100 years from now, 50 years from now. I know we kind of get this in the business world once in a while. You know, we kind of get the people who are saying, this is the trend. And that's partly what I'm talking about. But what about a voice like that in everyday culture? More along the lines of, here's what might be coming. What would it take in that context to work toward a better world? And less along the lines of, here's how we could blunt our sorrow by kind of consuming ourselves into a satiated numbness, you know? I want to offer a suggestion. This isn't meant to be directive, but it's meant to get us kind of wondering about something. It often seems to me that the voice of the Christian perspective, if you want to use that broad phrase like that, at this time of the year, is not only embattled, but has become strident in a really unappealing way. And I know it's highly subjective. You could feel free to directly disagree any time, but I want to say this one that way. This whole Jesus is the reason for the season thing, it strikes me as sort of greeting card spirituality. It kind of feels to me like the reduction of something profound to the lowest common denominator. Maybe it's just an acknowledgement that this is the level of the playing field and we're going to play on that level. I'm not saying that's without merit, but it's not also without danger. It feels to me more like following culture than like leading culture. And I think that's a problem. One of the reactions in the Christian church to the rampant consumption of this season has been to kind of go crazy on Christmas, just kind of pouring all kinds of energy and time and resources into the day, into the pageant, into the event of Christmas. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but have you ever had the experience on the other side of that enormous expenditure of energy, of hollowness? Just kind of this bong, like just there's nothing on the other side of it, except, you know, paying off the credit card. Given that the whole story that we're in points toward a world in which everything that is wrong is unmade, the sensation that after we celebrate what many would treat as the central event in the story, the coming of Jesus, the sensation that after we celebrate that nothing has changed and we have nothing left to live for, to work toward, to anticipate with hope, to me that points to a really significant problem with the nature of the celebration itself. And I think sometimes in an attempt to offer a corrective to all of this, Christendom has decided to make more of the season of Advent. And I think that's not a bad idea, really. It might even be a very good idea, but I also think that the way that we approach the season of Advent has a lot to do with whether that turns out to be a helpful idea or not. Because we can approach Advent as the on-ramp to Christmas. And I think that often happens in this attempt. And what I mean by that is sort of, I'm going to illustrate it negatively with something that can also be very positive, but it's sort of symbolic. We can, when we gather, kind of light a different colored candle each Sunday and then really light it up for Christmas Day, and then we're all done. But I can't help but think that in terms of being thoughtful about what Christmas is about, even though that's a big improvement on the alternative, which is just to show up for the day itself, it still feels to me like it has sort of an internal anticipatory logic that feels an awful lot like what is being done to me at the mall. And what I mean by that is that what happens increasingly, and this you can see this in the way advertisers move the date for when you should start your Christmas shopping earlier and earlier. So now we barely have Halloween cleared off the shelves, right? And this starts to happen. What's the message inside of a lot of that early advertising? The message, explicit or implicit, in a lot of that early advertising is that if you start sooner, you will do better. And underneath that, of course, as any good advertiser knows, there has to be a driver. There has to be something that inhabits the must. Otherwise, we won't respond. We won't obey. We won't take our direction from the advertisement, which is what we need to do in order to behave like well-trained consumers, right? Implicit in that is this idea that if you're smart, you'll start your shopping early because that way you'll get the best gifts possible and the people you give them to will be very happy
and that is roughly equivalent to what you're longing for. In other words, start sooner, and this will make better what is not good. That's a big hook. And it goes in right about here, and it comes out right about here. And it tugs us. If I think of an idea like that, in terms of the lament that so far I've kind of been unloading on you guys, this approach to Advent feels more like an extension of the lament than any kind of address or redress of it. If the lament that the Christmas story is addressing itself to the deeper lament of our experience of brokenness in life, our experience of suffering and hurt and even of death, then doing something that gets us more pumped about a particular day is not likely going to inform our imagination deeply enough to really cause much more than an annual disappointment. That's kind of the net result. Maybe that's why so many people hate Christmas. It's kind of like watching an entire culture get duped. It's painful. If I was going to try to characterize it in short phrases, I'd say that this run-up to Christmas in our culture, including in our Christian subculture, can kind of be like, this is going to make it better. This is going to make it better. This is going to make it better. Pop! Fooled you. Pay up. And there's just this precipice on the other side of the buildup. I think that the story that we inhabit, if we inhabit the story of Christianity, is really different than that. And I think it's a story that actually starts to hit its stride pretty early on. It starts to hit its stride biblically in the book of Isaiah with some oracles, some predictions about the future. And there are four of those that historically Christendom has treated in particular as Advent oracles, oracles that point toward what's to come, that we mark in this season. I'm going to sum those up for you. They're in Isaiah chapter 2, 7, 11, and 35. If you want to know the specific references for the ones I'm talking about, let me know. They are fascinating and well worth reading. We just won't take the time for that this morning. The first of those oracles talks about a coming age when nations seeking wisdom will stream to the mountain of the Lord. That's sort of the language. The next one talks with real confidence about a coming day when warriors are going to hammer their weapons into gardening tools. And another one predicts a world in which there is so much radical safety and so much relational ease that a lamb and a lion lie down peacefully together. And another one, the last one, talks about a virgin giving birth to a child that will lead us. On first take, if we're thinking about what's to come, the shape of things to come, those all sound, they sound pretty good, you know? That's good stuff. I mean, the idea of nations choosing to stream to the mountain of the Lord, lots of us have heard that oracle characterized as Christendom wins. Woo! All right, everyone becomes a Christian. It's a very common sort of take on that oracle. What about weapons turning into gardening tools? Well, one way to think about that oracle is finally all the beauty queen pageant contestants get what they want. Right? World peace. This is awesome. Finally. You know, we don't have to listen to anybody say, Jim, world peace anymore. What about the wolf lying down with the lamb? Well, you know what? That's a pretty happy oracle too, because really, you could understand it simply as that in the future, the global bully just ran out of work. Fabulous. Nobody likes a bully. Woman giving birth to a child that'll lead us? Well, that's just a nice story. That's just got all the warm fuzzies you could want. It's kind of touching and it evokes tender feelings. I like it. We could legitimately spend a lot of time on the nature of those oracles. What they are about. Are they about things that would happen in the near future from when they were written? Are they things that were only kind of in the context of the culture into which they were offered? Are they things that are further in the future but have already happened? Are they things that are still to come? Are they all of the above? We could examine that. There's lots to dig around in there.
But what if they're all of that and possibly something else entirely? What would happen if we looked at things in the Bible that we call oracles with less concern about their chronology and more concern about the shape of their narrative? What if we looked at the pictures in those oracles of a better world and we didn't look at them as though they were photorealism? What if we looked at them not as though they were all filled in, but as though they were more like preliminary drawings, more like sketches that outline something? They weren't the kind of directions you get from your GPS. They were the kind of directions you get from an ancient culture. If we thought about them that way, if we thought about them as sketch outlines, what might they be outlining? I'm going to take them one at a time. I think this is, for me at least, this has been a fruitful way to think about these. So the first one that talks about nations streaming to the mountain of the Lord. It's not any kind of an interpretive reach to understand the writer in Isaiah to, in talking about the mountain of the Lord, to be talking about Jerusalem. And that's very common in the language of the period. I've been to Jerusalem, and not only was Jerusalem the cultural center of that ancient age in which this oracle was written, but geographically, it's actually physically the high point of the topography. It is the nearest thing to the mountain in the area. It's the Ochapuase Mountain of Israel. It's the high point. Here's the thing. Things don't stream uphill. Things stream downhill. We all know that. That's gravity. We might not know what it is, but we know how it works. It is deeply counter to everything that we know to think of things streaming up the mountain to something. It's not only counter to the way things work in nature, it's also counter to the way things work in us. And what I mean by that is that generally speaking, as humans, we tend to be a bit fearful in general. We're very committed, broadly speaking, to securing things for ourselves. And so along comes this story that, if we're following the Christian narrative, this is the story of Jesus. So along comes this long-awaited Messiah. Comes into the story as a vulnerable child, born in poverty. He's born under morally suspect circumstances. And shortly after he's born, he has to flee for his life as a political refugee. And after 33 years of life, he has only managed to muster a handful of followers, and most of those bail as soon as things get difficult. And then eventually he suffers a barbaric and humiliating death at the hands of an illegitimate tyrant. That is not what most of the people were expecting from this story. And it's not what most of us would be longing for either. And yet, it is, in the shape of this story, the closest thing that we have to the mountain of the Lord, to this pinnacle event in the narrative. What kind of rearranging of our default internal logic would it take to think about the main character of that story as the savior of anything, let alone of the world? What in the world would make us look with hope toward the idea that that narrative is one that nations would stream toward? It's not hard to see how that would be uphill to stream toward that story, is it? But that's what the oracle says is going to happen. Well, what about this weapons hammered into gardening tools? That's just a lovely thought to consider. In our time, I imagine decommissioned tanks with combine headers on them. I don't know. Like, what does that look like? Here's the thing. This is a Canadian moment. As Canadians, we share, among other things, the longest undefended border on the planet with a very powerful nation. The most powerful economy in the world. It does not take an economic genius to understand what that economy, and subsequently in many ways our economy as a nation, is predicated on. It is predicated on not just the likelihood, but the reality of war and the economic opportunity that is generated by that.
If we want to watch the North American economy collapse in very short order, all we would have to do is pull the plug on arms manufacture and export. And that's what we would see happen. That's what the numbers say. It's not ideological, it's just math.
I'm not saying that to be critical of our neighbor to the south, or by extension in any particular way to offer a condemning critique of us, but rather to raise this question: what kind of radical shift in worldview would it take for us to move away from this way of life into a view of what is best for all that actually pivots on the giving up of military might in exchange for taking on anything that is fruitful and shared that cultivates a better world culture? What would that take? What kind of a shift would that take? It's an enormous shift. And it's hard to believe, honestly, for me anyway, that for us as Western Christians, we're so deeply vested in this narrative in Christendom that says, come to Jesus, and what happens when you come to Jesus is that he makes everything good. And he secures everything for you. All you have to do, and I can point you to the text, all you have to do is be faithful. And Jesus will make everything good. We have so much into that narrative. Honestly, how can we defend those kind of Jesus came to make everything good and secure for those that follow him, belief structures and narratives, when from the beginning of the story, that's not the shape of it? What about lambs and lions lying down together? A friend of mine was recently at a peace conference, and he met some folks there who are part of an intentional mixed community of Arabs and Jews in Israel. They live together by choice. They live together intentionally with the intent of being a visible witness that is counter to the prevailing narrative in the region, which is a narrative of conflict and violence and my way or your way, but there's no way together. And one of the pairs of people that he met there were a couple, Arab man and a Jewish woman. And when he met them, he kind of joked with them that their unlikely relationship seems to hearken to this oracle, to this lion and the lamb lying down together. And the Arab guy kind of got this twinkle in his eye, and he said, well, I'll just have to leave it to you to decide which one of us is the lion and which one is the lamb. Really, if we had to choose whether we would rather be thought of as the lion or the lamb, most of us would choose the lamb. The lamb is the nice character in this story, right? And that's what I would prefer. And so I go there, right? I tally up the good things I've done. I tally up my gentle moments. I tally up my honest moments. I tally up my listening moments, my caring moments, my good stuff. I go, yeah, good. That side of the ledger is looking very lamb-like. I'm doing okay, you know? That's a nice feeling. And then, every once in a while, usually provoked from outside of myself, I have to tally the other side of the ledger, and I have to pay attention to the way that I heedlessly eat, drive, enjoy leisure, consume entertainment, buy clothing, pick one, without thinking about their cost. I just eat them up. And I think, yeah, I'm looking kind of woeful on that side of the story. What would it take, do you think, really, for the lions to lie down with the lambs peacefully? What if, for that to happen in the world, I had to give up the way that I live in the regards that I've mentioned, and maybe in some other ways as well? I'm a dad, and if I read this oracle, the end of the picture, it sort of starts with this lion and lamb image, and it's so compelling that people are just stuck there. But at the end, it has a child sticking its hand into an adder's nest and pulling it out unharmed. Would it benefit us, do you think, for me to name the adder's nests of our time? The ones that children stick their hands into and don't come out unscathed? I can just name the nests, people. I can name the people. in some instances, that are in there. What if, for my child to grow up in a world like that, of that kind of radical peace and deep safety, I had to give up things that I prefer and take on hedonism? What if? What if that's what the oracle is pointing toward?
Last one. The virgin will conceive and bear a son, name him well, name him Emmanuel, God with us, and this child is going to lead us, apparently. Just for a second, without thinking too hard about it, let's consider the known history of leadership in the world in which we live. For good or for ill, it would be fair to say that the gender that got us to the point at which we find ourselves, in terms of leadership, was almost entirely male. Men? Interesting thought that the oracle suggests to us that what's coming, the shape of things to come, has to do somehow with the women and the children. And I think that's a hard thought for us to even start to collectively consider. I don't know how many of you guys know who Stephen Lewis is. He's an AIDS champion. I don't know how to even describe the guy. Among other things, the person behind the Stephen Lewis Foundation, which works with community-level organizations that are, their job, their mission in the world is to turn the tide of HIV/AIDS in Africa in particular. And they do that by providing care and support to women, to orphan children, to grandmothers, and to people that are living with HIV/AIDS. And since 2003, they've funded over 700 initiatives. They've partnered with over 300 community-based organizations in 15 African countries. I mean, these guys are doing it. Stephen Lewis is a fantastic communicator. Just Google any podcast with his name on it, and he will grab you by the lapels and haul you into the story. He's fantastic at this. And when he talks about turning the tide of AIDS in Africa, he just pounds away on this single drum over and over again. He just says, one way or another, it's the women that are doing the work that actually is stemming and turning this tide in Africa. Those are the people who know what's going on. Those are the people who know what needs to be done to improve the situation. In this particular lecture that I heard him give last week, he talked about an international summit on AIDS in Africa that was convened about a year ago. And the organizers were very proud of this summit. They had gathered leaders in this issue from all around the world. And there were 20-some people on this panel. Two of them were women. Lewis, when he talks about this, he's just incensed. And in fact, these are his words. This is what he said in this particular lecture. And he's not talking about the powerless when he says these things. He said, what in God's name were they thinking? Where are the women? Why are they not at the table? What if that's what the oracle's talking about? What shape would that have on our faith? On the way we live it? Maybe, happy Advent, right? Maybe this is all just too much to consider. Maybe this is just way too far away from the way our culture engages with the thing that we would call Advent. Maybe this is nothing like the on-ramp to a happy, happy day. After which, what? A better world? Maybe we have to have a way longer view to even consider things like this. I don't really know, but what I feel like I'm coming to believe is that the radical nature of the reversals that would be required for a set of oracles like this to even kind of move toward fulfillment is enormous. And maybe, in the end, I don't want a better world that much. Because moving toward this oracular better world, if I've characterized it with any fairness at all, seems to require giving up a lot of things that I hold dear or simply assume to be my right. It's a hard idea. Now, what does all that have to do with Advent in particular? In contrast to the experience of Advent as the on-ramp to Christmas, what would happen, do you think,
if we imagined Advent as a time for seriously considering what it is that might keep us from attending to what we need to attend to, so that the vision these oracles offer of a better world might move a little bit closer to being a reality. What if we spent Advent that way? There's a lot to celebrate in Christmas. I haven't talked about that much this morning. I started in a different place, and sometimes you need to do that. I felt like I needed to do that. But what if we thought about Advent that way? Maybe this is helpful. I found it helpful. I hope it will be to you. The ancients in this story talked about something they called the threefold coming of Christ. What they meant by that is that when we think about the coming of Christ into the story, we need to think about it in three different time frames. We can think about the coming of Christ in the past. So this is sort of what we celebrate at Christmas. We can think about the coming of Christ in the present tense. Christ in our time, real time, right now. And we can think about the coming of Christ in the future. We would regard, generally speaking, with some noteworthy exceptions, the coming of Christ in the past as an historic fact, an event. There was someone named Jesus that came into the story. What we make of that varies wildly, but there we go. There's the past. As Christians, we make a great deal of that coming. And when we think about Jesus coming in the future, again, there's sort of lots of different takes on that, but generally speaking, in Christendom, we anticipate a return of Christ at some real point in history in a way that breaks into time and, again, sort of unmakes all that is false. Maybe the toughest time frame to actually think about, engage with the coming of Christ is the present tense. If we treat Advent as the on-ramp to Christmas, and Christmas as a terminal event in the story, we are engaging with Advent in terms of the coming of Christ from the perspective of the past. But we're staying stuck there. And if all we do is say, hope's coming, it's in the Northeast, it's out there somewhere, again, not a bad thing, but it's a partial thing, we can end up living, in terms of our faith, as though everything good about it was stuck somewhere out there in the future. And we're looking forward to it, but it's not really now. It's coming, and that's good, but it's over there, generally, somewhere. What about the present? What does it look like to watch for the presence of Christ in the present? Because when we start to do that, that's when we start to be challenged by the presence of Christ in a way that actually adjusts us, that actually challenges the way that we live in the present. But we have to attend. We have to be attentive to the presence of Christ for that to happen. How do we do that? Most of us aren't good at that. We haven't practiced much. I think maybe it's part of it. Well, you know what the good news is, I think, in this idea of attending to the presence of Christ in the present? Is it's not a package that arrives, that we open and suddenly we are able to attend. It's much more like moving from being a sedentary person to somebody who would go run a 10K because you wanted to. To use an embodied illustration, it sort of starts with, first of all, kind of getting your ass off the couch. Like, you have to actually stand up. But that's an actual move. It's actually part of getting to place ass. Attending is like that. We can begin wherever we are and simply start by paying attention for a moment. I'm not talking about suddenly being the person who's able to attend to the presence of Christ in every moment of the day. Wouldn't that be something? But I don't know any humans that could do that. And I don't actually think that's the way God unfolds this in us. That sounds kind of like we would be basically puppets in that story, not actors. And we're actors. We actually get to practice this. We actually get to learn it incrementally. What do you think would happen if we went into this week and we watched for the presence of Christ in simple things? We watched for the presence of Christ in encouragement, when someone gives someone else some courage. Courage is pinned to hope, and hope is pinned to a picture of the future, but it's pinned there in the present. Heard a story this week about a woman who was staying in a woman's shelter. Very bottom of the curve of her life story.
went into the media room to kind of be alone. Another woman, an older woman that she'd seen around, came into that room and said to her, she says, and I'll tell the story, she had this lovely demeanor, very gentle, soft-spoken. She came to her and she said, I've seen you in this room a few times, but you never talk, and you don't seem to have anything. So I want to give you half of what I have. And she reached in her jacket pocket, and she took out, and it turned out half of what she had in the world were 2 cans of soup and $20. And she gave this woman that. In this particular story, that changed the direction of that woman's life. The point now where she's telling the story, she's a university professor, she leads a nonprofit organization that seeks to do more broadly what she experienced in that moment. I mean, it altered her life. Encouragement. What kind of story was that happened in that room? As a person of faith in Christ, to me, that's a moment that is a beacon for the presence of Christ in the world. A bringer of hope. A bringer of a picture of the future that is different than the picture we're experiencing in the present. But it's one that is brought to the person in the present. Watch for encouragement. Watch for tenderness. Watch for kindness. Watch for beauty. Watch for wonder. Watch for suffering. Because there are things that are only spoken and only lived there. I wish I could keep going. I believe that the world is suffused with the presence of Christ. To me, that's the source of hope. That doesn't mean there's nothing that challenges it. It doesn't mean that sometimes it goes completely missing in action. Because it does. But it will stay missing in action unless somebody attends. Maybe that's our call. Maybe that's what Advent is for. For us to pay attention.
Maybe our byword for Advent should be a phrase something like, watch for him. And I wonder if that mightn't feed fairly logically into the byword for a new year being something like, act like him. Amen.